Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to this edition of Inside Scoop Live. This is one of many features presented to you by Reader Views. I'm your host, Gail Campbell. Hello, and thank you for tuning in. Today I'm chatting with Stephen Paul Mark about his new book, Drift. But before we dive into this exciting book, I'd like to tell you a little bit about Steve. He has been in the practice of entertainment and media law for over 30 years. About half of that time has been spent as an executive in the legal and business affairs departments of such major entertainment entities as William Morris Agency, Homebox Office, MTV Networks, and others. He designed the business affairs departments at HBO for original and sports programming, as well as for Comedy Central, and created some of the early deal architecture for Nickelodeon's original productions. As a practicing attorney, he has represented such clients as George Carlin, John Douglas, Rich Little, Life Magazine, the founder of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, JP Kids, Maternal Fitness, a Merchant Ivory Development Fund, Sam Shepard, Home Box Office, Culture, International Films, The Howard Stern Show, Jump the Shark, and many more than those. Currently, Steve's practice includes a wide variety of clients in traditional areas such as film, television, and publishing, as well as an active client list in new technologies such as HDTV, wireless, broadband TV, and Internet matters. Wow, Steve, what a resume. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Gail.
Well, it's exciting. Your book is exciting. Is this your first novel?
It's the first novel I've published. I actually finished another one a couple years ago, but I'm going to rewrite that one.
Well, one would have to wonder, given the dynamic life you're already leading, which sounds pretty full, where did you find time to squeeze in writing a book?
Weekends, late at night, early in the morning. sometimes when I just needed a break from the clients.
I know for a fact that sometimes when those ideas are just jumping all around in your mind, the only thing you can do is give into it and get up and write.
Well, sometimes the muse is there and you have no idea, or you don't have the time, I should say. Sometimes you have the time and the muse is nowhere to be found. So finding that great combination of inspiration and the time to do it.
Well, about your book, Drift, would you take a few moments and give the audience a little of the essence of the book?
From a plot perspective?
Yes.
Well, it's about this fellow named Max La Follette. The very first lines of the book. He comes home one day from an interview, and he opens his front door, and there's a gun stuck in his head.
Wow.
And it turns out that he had an interview earlier in the day at an oil company. He had been watching a ticker tape parade for the New York Yankees, and a memo, sort of an errant memo, falls against his shoulder. And as he reads it, and he sees that someone named Brand is getting terminated at this oil company. So since he's just been fired, he figures he can go up and maybe land a job at this oil company. So when he goes up there and they ask him how he found out about the company, he tells them, he mentions the name of this fellow in the memo who's just being terminated, which was probably the worst thing he could do. Anyway, he goes home, and these two thugs are there waiting for him, and they start asking him all about this fellow named Brand, who was listed in the memo.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he doesn't know anything about him. He just sort of mentioned it to him.
He thought he had stumbled across a great opportunity, huh?
Yeah, fortune was shining on him, except as these thugs are questioning him, the place is ransacked. They've obviously been looking for something. And just about the point at which their patience has run out, the New York City police are coming up the stairs of his apartment, because evidently there was a fight the night before between he and his wife.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thugs leave, and the cops get there, and they start looking around at this ransacked apartment, thinking that there was indeed a huge fight between his wife and him, and
mm-hmm.
the cops ask to come in, and they look around the apartment, and they happen to find his Max's wife dead.
Oh,
in the bedroom.
Oh, my. And he
So now he's wanted by the New York City police. He's wanted by this oil company named Imperium, and he basically has nowhere to go. And he goes out on the street the next day, and these thugs find him again. And they're going to lead him to Imperium's headquarters, probably to question him some more and ultimately dispatch him if he doesn't have the right information.
Because their use of termination was not meant in terms of firing somebody. They really meant terminate
they
someone,
meant
didn't
the
they?
Final
right.
termination.
Exactly.
So as these thugs are leading him to the corporate headquarters, there's a slight earthquake. This is all take place in Manhattan. There's a slight earthquake. He's able to get away, and he runs into a subway station by City Hall downtown. The thugs keep chasing him. He runs onto a track, and he's able to escape, but then he finds himself getting locked into a room by somebody, some stranger. And about a day later, he's let out. It's a homeless guy who leads him to a community of homeless people living in the tunnels under New York City. And it turns out that the leader of this community is Brand, the fellow that the oil company was looking for.
Oh,
that's where Brand escaped as well.
Ah, so he meets the fellow that they're also looking for to exterminate.
Exactly. So now you've got these two homeless guys with nothing, with everything to lose if they go up to the surface, but together they begin plotting the, the payback for this oil company.
Okay, and now just so the audience is clear about this. Your the setting for your book, it's contemporary time frame in New York, but experiencing a whole set of environmental and geographical phenomena that are unusual globally, right?
Right. The setting on the first day, as the book opens, is a late October day where the temperature is in excess of 80 degrees.
In New York?
In New York,
mm-hmm,
right.
Mm-hmm.
And all over the rest of the planet, there's all kinds of strange weather anomalies. As a matter of fact, in Southern California, there's a scientist named Becky Hausman at Caltech who's studying the strange earthquake activity, and she ultimately comes to New York to give a lecture, and the engineers ask her to come down with them into the tunnels under Manhattan to look at the damage that this slight earthquake caused when Max was able to get away from those two thugs.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, while she's down there, there's an aftershock, and there's a cave-in, and she's trapped, along with one of the other engineers who's seriously injured. And, of course, Max's underground community hear about this, and they start looking for her, and they actually find her and lead her and the injured man back to a point where they could easily be found. But then Max and his colleagues have to disappear, because they don't want anybody to know where they are.
Right.
So he makes some contact with this Caltech scientist, who he later goes to try to enlist her support in fighting this oil company, because the oil company has a plan to alter continental drift by deep drilling technology. And as it turns out, Bran is the stepson of the CEO who runs the oil company.
Oh, wow.
So Bran knows the agenda. Imperium knows he knows the agenda, and they are looking for him because he is the only one that can disclose their plan.
Okay. So here is a novel that is set in contemporary times, and you have themes of corporate, not only corporate corruption, but corporate, what's the word?
Hegemony, I guess you'd call it, total power.
Total global power.
I mean, they're well beyond greed.
Right, yes, exactly, well beyond greed. And in fact, you have issues like that. You have issues of betrayal and breach of confidences, and as well as attempts at murder, if not outright murder, global manipulations on all scales, weaving through the plot of your story here. Where did you? I mean, obviously, dealing with the medium that you're dealing with, and the clientele that you're dealing with, the fact that you're out there in the world of entertainment and media law, you're interacting with entertainers and writers and networks that run programs like this, and of course, I mean, our own newspapers and news programming are filled with stories that would make great sources of information for books for a book like this, wouldn't they?
Easily. Every day you could pick up the newspaper and see something that simply defies reality. They say truth is stranger than fiction, and unfortunately, in many cases, it is.
Well, did you find it a challenge, or was it something that you could really easily get into in terms of global concerns about global warming? And there are global concerns about global warming.
Well, I actually thought about this plot about 15 years ago, maybe even more. I've always been fascinated by natural history and earth science, and I remember the day I actually looked at Africa and South America and thought I came up with this brilliant original idea that they must have been connected at one point, because they were.
Uh-huh.
But they just simply look like they would have fit together at some point in the ancient past. But of course, I later found out that a scientist named Alfred Wegener came up with the idea of continental drift
and plate tectonics.
The theory of continental drift, which operates on the science of plate tectonics,
mm-hmm.
which is simply the fact that dense land masses like the continents literally sit on the Earth's mantle, which is sort of a gooey, it's not quite watery, but it's kind of gooey, so that the pressure that the land masses bear on the gooey subsurface allows the continents to drift, hence the title. But I, as I said, I was interested in this, about 15 years ago, and I was very friendly with Tom Clancy's agent at the time. I'm still
mm-hmm.
friendly with him, but he's no longer Clancy's agent. I said, you know, does Clancy take ideas from, people on the outside? I have a great idea. I think he would do wonders with it. And he said, no, they don't like to do that kind of thing. They come up with their own ideas. And so that was kind of the end of that. But I've always, over that 15 years or so, I've always thought about what a great story it would make, and I kind of kept waiting for somebody to come out with it. And then I guess finally I just got to the point where I started thinking more about it and actually injected characters into the plot and started writing.
Well, I think that's great. And, why not a novel like this? My goodness, it includes so many of the things, not only environmental issues that we've already mentioned, but also economic issues, as well as other environmental issues like, an increase in devastating tsunamis and hurricanes and tsunamis of the magnitude that hadn't been seen prior to the last couple of years. And you've brought those threads into your novel as well.
Well, as I said, I had started thinking about this before global warming was even a concept that the media had grasped. In those days, they were talking about the hole in the ozone layer.
Mm-hmm.
You don't hear that talk anymore because it's been expanded to this general notion of overall global warming, not just a hole above the Antarctica that's, you know, going to let some sunlight in.
Right.
But I just hit it, luckily. The timing is just so perfect for it because every single day there's a major news story about something, whether it's the climate or the oil industry or, hurricanes, mudslides.
Exactly.
I really hit the timing right. Believe me, I wish I could have said, I saw this coming 15 years ago, but I definitely didn't.
No, I don't think anybody could have seen what we're seeing today. No one could have foreseen all that. I mean, who would have had any idea that the corporate environment would once again be behaving not across the board, obviously, not across the board, but certainly more than should be. More corporations are behaving beyond any perception of greed, which is not acceptable in the first place, but willing to behave in ways and take actions at others' expense. Well, in order for to further their own need for power and control.
Well, Imperium Solutions and the guy that runs it in my novel are really evil. I mean, it's not just about controlling oil reserves that no one else can reach and becoming the richest, literally the richest private entity on Earth. The reason they're altering continental drift is to close off some of the areas, landmass areas, like the mouth of the Persian Gulf. If you look at the map, there's a very, very narrow strait between the Persian Gulf and the Arabian Sea. And it wouldn't take a whole lot to just kind of push that gap closed. And once you do that, you have an inland, you no longer have a gulf out of which major oil tankers could traverse. You have a landlocked lake, basically,
mm-hmm.
a landlocked sea.
Mm-hmm.
So what Imperium is doing is they're buying up all the real estate along the areas that they know the continental drift is going to affect. So at the point at which the Persian Gulf is blocked or the Red Sea is blocked, somebody's going to have to deal with them to dig a canal through there, and they'll have total control over that landmass.
Over that region, wow. And what's under the surface of it as well.
Exactly.
Wow.
But oil is only oil for them is only a means to buy the real estate.
Right. Well, now, Steve, your book, it's been mentioned that your book included some physical and intellectual challenges. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I've been in a wheelchair since I was 18
mm-hmm.
as a result of a neck injury playing football.
Mm.
So even though I've traveled quite a bit in my life, most of it's been to fairly substantial cities like outside of the United States, like London, Edinburgh, that Toronto, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't gone to northern Turkey or the Republic of Georgia or Chechnya, for that matter. So I had to figure out a way to set my locations in a way that would make the reader feel like not only had I been there, but I lived there for considerable lengths of time. London was easy, obviously. New York was easy. So if it weren't for the Internet, this book could not have been written unless I had total time off to spend, 24/7 in a library.
Mm-hmm.
But with the Internet and with a little bit of creative research, you could make settings anywhere on Earth and make them seem very real. You've got pictures that are on websites. You've got maps. You've got satellite photographs. You can measure distances. At one point in the novel, they were flying from Europe to northern Turkey, and I had no idea how long that would take in a plane.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't going to be taking a commercial jet. They were going to be taking a small propeller plane. So how long would it take to get there? I had to compute. First of all, I had to find the model airplane that I wanted to use that could fit, the number of people that were traveling and,
mm-hmm.
and their luggage, the weight of their luggage. Then I had to compute the mileage, and then I had to make sure that there were sufficient airports along the way where they could land, refuel, and take off. And that took me about 2 days, but it was a lot of fun because, you know, I learned a lot about Cessnas, for instance.
Right, exactly.
So it was just, so even though that was a, even though the challenge of establishing locations was there, the Internet is just a godsend. I mean,
well, absolutely. I mean, my heavens, I think that is so true. With the ease and convenience of Internet in everyone's home, people can work from home now. And you're right. I mean, pretty much all research can be done from home.
I did that, but then as far as some of the locations, especially in New York and London, I actually have been to those locations. For instance, I was writing at one point, I think it was last winter, I was writing a portion of the book that had to do with a really bad snowstorm in New York. And we had 20 inches of snow.
Wow.
So I wanted to go out and see what the streets looked like at that point in a snowfall, when there was literally nobody else on the streets, no cars, no buses, no people. And I had driven to the location where I wanted to set the scene, and I basically just parked there for about half an hour and watched what happened. And part of that scene is in the book, and it's exactly the way it was. And I was able to describe it by having been there, and it was great.
How neat.
Yeah, it was great.
Well, and there are always challenges in writing any book, and you had these to deal with, as well as dealing with the challenge of making the plot, you know, be so real to the reader that the reader might ask, you know, did that really happen? Did he really do that? Did he really go there?
Right.
And you also injected a Dickens style of writing in this novel, didn't you?
I sure did.
Okay, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, Charles Dickens is my favorite author. Mm-hmm. I have all of his first editions except for Christmas Carol. I have tons and tons of stuff on Dickens. I just, except for possibly Shakespeare, but Shakespeare didn't write in a contemporary style.
Right.
Dickens is he's such a master of language that you don't even have to have the plot being driven forward in his books. Just looking at the way he uses language is an art form. I mean, it truly is an art form, and I just like the way he turns phrases.
Mm-hmm.
So, like for instance, if you were to read Bleak House, the first 2.5 pages are a description of London in the fog, and it's just brilliant how he describes how everything coats everything. So, on the one hand, I wanted to write a novel with touches of, I guess, what I'd call literature-level passages. But on the other hand, if you're writing a thriller, you have to pound the action forward, and you can't really spend a lot of time doing, you know, descriptions. So you have to kind of do your descriptions with metaphors, more like, I guess at one point I talked about Hell's Kitchen cooking up a casserole of crime. There's an area in New York City called Hell's Kitchen, and it used to be an area of a lot of crime.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of describing the area, I could just say that, you know, it was cooking up a casserole. And, But I love the way Dickens writes, and I strive to write like that, but obviously in today's reading population, it's very difficult to sustain a reader with that kind of literature.
Well, besides that, it's impossible to become somebody else. You are your own unique writer, and you have your own unique writing style, which may be a blend, which may include a blend of influence from other writers like Dickens, and even to maybe to a certain extent Shakespeare. But you know, it's your unique style and your own unique blend. So I applaud that. Now, how did you? You had some fun coming up with the title for this book too, didn't you?
Yeah.
Drift.
Well, the obvious title was simply Drift because of the notion of continental drift.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really a metaphor for what's going on about global warming today. I mean, we just drift today about it. Nobody seems to do anything about it. I mean, you used to say everybody talks about the weather, but nobody does anything about it. Well, you could apply that to global warming. I mean, it's something that we can control relatively easily, by some sacrifice and by alternative fuels and other technologies, but we just don't seem to have the commitment to do it. So,
well, and some of that might be due to the fact that that trying to overcome this enormous hurdle called the Energy Coalition global, which is what I'm going to call it. I am personally calling it an energy coalition, and I believe because of my past career, I have the right to call it that.
Right. I was worried that you would the objective in this interview.
No, absolutely.
Listeners, that you were an oil and gas.
That's right.
Executive at one point.
That's a past life. That is a past life on a small, very small scale. And of course, I was also involved with the Red Cross during the tsunamis and the hurricanes Katrina and Wilma. So, you know, having dabbled around these big issues from a little minuscule perspective, but I think even having been in the energy industry myself, we were just small independent producers, but I can tell you for a fact that we often felt that trying to overcome or crawl over the hurdles presented by big energy business sometimes it was unachievable. It was just not possible to achieve climbing over those hurdles. They can be enormous. So whether you're on the inside or not, if you're not one of the big players, you might as well not be.
Yeah. Well, the thing that troubles me so much, I guess, about all this is that corporations are made up of people. I mean, it's not like there's some kind of separate.
No, that's right.
Source of intelligence.
They're us.
Yeah, and it's people that make these decisions that affect so much. Now they'll tell you that they're protecting their stockholders or whatever. But the fact of the matter is that people have the power to change things. We're a country where you can vote in your leaders. You can't do that in a corporation if you're an employee. I mean, I guess you can do it as a stockholder, but usually there's no way that stockholders can band together to kick out the bums, so to speak.
Well, and far too often, and I hate to say it, having been on both sides of the issue, but the truth of the matter is that when you're in the boardroom as a stockholder, your concern is oftentimes more of a personal nature, like how well is my investment going to perform here? You know.
Well, you know what? If there are no more trees, and no more unpolluted streams,
mm-hmm.
and no more wildlife preserves,
mm-hmm.
what's the point?
Exactly.
You know, what's the point?
But more times than not, unfortunately, we tend to be a little too short-sighted. And that's what has to stop. We have to stop being so short-sighted, and we have to be willing to look beyond our own personal wants and look at a global need, in my opinion.
Well, I couldn't agree more.
Well, Steve, we are getting close to running out of time here. I'm amazed, but I'm always amazed when this moment draws near. And what I want to ask you really quickly, what message would you like for the reader to gain from reading your book?
Well, I want the reader to have fun, first of all. That's why I wrote it. I wrote it as a real thriller. It's a great plot, and it drives forward, and it's an amazing climax. I mean, just an amazing climax.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people, if this ever gets made into a movie, I suspect they'll be standing up and screaming at the screen at the end, cheering things on. I mean, it truly is an amazing climax. But so most of all, it's about enjoying the read.
Mm-hmm.
Second, and I guess it's become more important over the last couple of years, is that I want people to see what can happen to an environment in a relatively quick and easy manner.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Earth is so fragile that it doesn't take a whole lot to change things.
Well, I would actually suggest that the Earth is not fragile, but that our way of life is fragile, and that if we keep pushing this thing to the point, or that we could keep pushing this thing to the point where our way of life is what we'll lose. The Earth will simply adapt, but our way of life may not.
That's true. I just hope we're not a species that's studied 75 million years from now.
No kidding.
You know, and everybody, all of those people wondering,